Michelle T is a big deal in some circles. She's an author and a queer feminist icon who's published and toured prolifically. She used to be known for wild antics and an artist's crazy life in San Francisco, but since getting sober, she's been writing about those early years like a compassionate older sibling with a sense of humor. Michelle T is coming to the Raven Bookstore in Lawrence later this month, and she's published so many books so recently that I wasn't sure which book she'd be talking about, so I've been reading two of them. One is a memoir called How to Grow Up. It starts like this. Perhaps some of you have glided into adulthood with all the grace of a swan, skimming lightly into an adult living situation, adult relationships, adult jobs and income, and most important, an adult sense of confidence, of a solid place in the world, of stability. Who are you people? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're going to chat with Michelle T about her life, her work, and growing up. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Thanks.
Good morning.
Hi to you too. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I think a lot of people in the arts can probably relate to this uneven path to adulthood that you chronicle in growing and How to Grow Up.
I think so too. I mean, I credit my uneven path to so many things, being queer, being having grown up low income and remained low income into adulthood. But really being an artist really sets you up for an unstable life. I mean, it's so fun too, right? Because you get to do things that do retain a sense of childishness or youthfulness that I think probably a lot of people wish they could retain in their life. So it's a mixed bag.
For people who experience the arts mostly from like an audience perspective, I think that path to getting to be that person who has an audience isn't all that well understood. Can you talk a little bit more about it?
Sure. I mean, I think it's not even well understood by artists themselves, you know? I think that there's, especially with a writer, I don't know, it's like you can sort of, there are people who go to college, right? And they maybe meet a professor who kind of takes them under their wing and maybe shows their work to, you know, an agent, and then they start getting published and they make money on their books. And then there's like everybody else. So most writers don't actually make very much money on their books. And you can be very wildly known and have a lot of readers, but that doesn't really mean that that author is actually making an income that can even support them. So it's really confusing. I remember having this really terribly demeaning job. I don't even want to, I'm embarrassed to even say what it is. It was like, I was basically handing out free packs of cigarettes to smokers at bars in San Francisco. And this was a great job for a moment in San Francisco that a lot of people were scrambling for because it paid $15 an hour, which was a lot. And you only worked at night, and you basically just went from bar to bar looking for people who were already smoking and being like, do you want cigarettes? So it was a gross job, but it kind of worked its purpose. And I remember I was doing this job and somebody came up to me and said, oh, you're Michelle T. I've read your books. Why are you doing this? And I just felt so much rage at being so like having my life so deeply misunderstood by this stranger. Like, what do you think it means to be Michelle T? You know, what do you think it means to be a small press feminist queer writer who makes like, you know, works on a book for a year? And for my third book, I was able to get $5,000 for it. But, you know, for my second book, I only got $1,500. And for my first, I got $100.
$100 for a whole book, like divided up by the hour. Is that like a quarter of a penny per hour or something?
Yeah, I mean, it's really crazy. And I was also told up front, you'll never see a royalty for it, because at the time that the person who owned that press was pretty unethical and wasn't really paying their writers. But I was just so thrilled to be published. You know, I had, that was such a dream that I didn't think I could make come true for myself. Again, like having not gone to college, having really not known people who published books, I was thrilled. And I was going to be published, you know, among a bunch of my literary heroes. So I was like, I'll pay you $100 for this opportunity.
When you talk about your uneven path to growing up and you say you credit it to a lot of things, including being queer, can you explain that piece of it?
Well, sure. I mean, I'm 47 years old. So when I was coming of age, being queer was like illegal in lots of places, you know? I mean, you couldn't, there were there were people who would, you know, we didn't have any protection. And even in the places where we maybe had legal protection, there was no social or cultural protection. Even in San Francisco, where I moved in my early 20s, there were gay bashings that happened really regularly. And it's known to be, you know, such a queer positive town always, but it was really rough. And, you know, you just grew up just knowing that you were sort of outside of the culture and that a lot of things were not going to be accessible to you. Especially if you were the kind of queer that I am, which is, you know, kind of holding a more radical politic and allowing my queerness to be a lens for me to view the culture, you know, being sort of like, ever since I was younger, saying like, okay, so this culture doesn't like queer people. Who else doesn't it like? Oh, there's a lot of racism, right? There's people don't like, you know, homeless people, you know, it gave me an allegiance and an alliance with everybody in our culture who sort of gets kind of pushed to the side. And then when you have that point of view and you're allowing it to shape your life, you end up getting limited. You have limited opportunities. So, and again, there's like a blessing and a curse to that. It's like nobody wants to live in poverty and nobody wants unequal protection under the laws of your country. But you also see things with a lot of clarity and you get to sort of make up your own rules as you go along. So there's a lot of freedom to it.
You know, yeah, I mean, part of what I feel like you're writing about in your recent work is being torn between the lifestyle that made you part of that larger group and the lifestyle that you suddenly had, I mean, I shouldn't say suddenly, that you gradually got access to as someone getting jobs, teaching at colleges and having more of an income and being sober and all of these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that something that happens to a lot of marginalized people is you become extremely identified with your marginalization. And I think that's really powerful. You know, when I realized, you know, I grew up in a really, you know, poor town, everyone was pretty poor. So it wasn't till I left that town and became part of the wider world where I started meeting people who, you know, I remember accidentally seeing a friend's bank account in my 20s and she had $3,000 in the bank. And I just gasped. I was like, oh my God, she's rich. I hadn't known. She must have a trust fund. I mean,
she's a thousandaire.
Yeah. I mean, I now see this as a pretty basic amount of money to have in your bank account for survival. You know, it's also much more expensive to live these days than it was in the 90s. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's, I feel like I want you to rephrase your question so I can get into it a little bit deeper.
Well, rather than rephrasing the question, why don't we just talk about, there's an excerpt that I'd really like you to read.
Sure.
And I'm going to set up the scene first. You've moved back at this point into a house with roommates after a breakup at the age of almost 40. At this point in your life, you don't have to live in a house like this anymore. You have furniture that you bought yourself instead of dragging in from the curb, which had been kind of the model for getting furniture from this earlier phase in your life. Compared to your younger roommates, you are this real live grown-up that you very much still doubt you know how to be. Can you talk about that a little bit before we get into the excerpt?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just like I was sort of just believing. Okay, I guess my larger point here is that when you form your ideas about yourself, and those ideas get formed when you're younger, and they're very impacted by the ways that you're marginalized or oppressed and what your limitations are. And if you can hold very tightly to those things almost in a political way, you know, as like I became very identified with being like I'm a working class person or a broke person, you know, I'm a marginalized person. And it's important to stake that and to lead with it sometimes, because especially like in a literary world, it's presumed that I've gone to college. It's presumed that I had an upbringing that was like the very middle class upbringings of the people that I'm around. And it's important, I think, for people to open their eyes and recognize like, you know, that's the privilege of being in the upper classes, is that you just think everybody's had your experience. And so it's very important to kind of lead with that for political change and for awareness. But then you don't realize that you've locked yourself into this identity, and maybe your experience has changed a little bit and you're still identifying as like a super broke person who can't afford X, Y, and Z, but you haven't taken the step back to look around and say, oh, actually, you know, you can afford these things. And sometimes it's just a big blind spot. And sometimes it's it's a little bit more psychologically complex than that. Like, you're afraid to become that person that you have sort of inadvertently demonized, you know?
Yeah, there's a scene where you have been sort of sneakily getting magazine subscriptions by putting a fake name on a real address.
Yeah.
And then not paying. And
it's true. I was stealing from Vogue.
But then realizing how much a magazine subscription actually cost and that you could afford it.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's like $10 or $12 a year, you know, and I was like getting these magazines and then not paying the bill. And they just keep coming to you for a while. So you can kind of scam them for a while. And, you know, part of getting sober, the way that I got sober through a 12-step program is being honest, you know, and that can get looked at as like a really moral thing, like, oh, you know, now you're going to be a moral goody-goody. But it's really about excavating the different fears that you're holding onto and looking at the way those fears determine your actions and then determine your life in a lot of ways. So I had to look at, oh, it wasn't kind of like, oh, you're doing a bad thing, you're stealing from Vogue. Like, that's arguable, you know? It's more like, what are you afraid of right now that is causing you basically to lie and steal? And it's like, oh, I'm afraid of being so poor that I'm homeless. And some irrational part of my brain, because of my upbringing and my earlier years, thinks that if I give $12 for a magazine subscription, it's a slippery slope and it's going to have terrible ramifications down the road. Well, so I had to look at that and see it for what it was.
I want you to read this excerpt now about why growing up into the kind of adult that you are now wasn't simple for you, and why it's not so simple for a lot of people. Do you have the excerpt in front of you?
I do. Yeah, I do. I'll read it. It's from my book, How to Grow Up. And it goes, when it's hard for you to grow up because you're poor and can't afford the trinkets and milestones of adulthood, or you're gay and the mating rites of passage don't seem to apply to you, or you are sensitive to the world's injustices and decided long ago that if being a grown-up means being an a-hole, you'll carry out your days in Neverland with the rest of the lost children, thank you very much. When adulthood seems somehow off-limits to you, growing up takes time. You have to want it, and then you have to make a lot of changes. Some changes you make consciously, and some without knowing it, and some changes get made for you. It's so much work, I forgot I was even engaged in it. It just became life. Sometimes you're so caught up in old ideas about yourself, it takes another person to show you who you actually are today. And the person you are today is a lot more grown up than the last time you checked.
I love that. If you are a fan of Michelle T and want to ask her a question, you can call 816-235-2888. The author is coming to Lawrence for a reading on September 20th. Michelle, I mean, I was kind of getting at this a little bit ago, but talk about your relationship with fashion. That's how you get into this whole fashion magazine thing in the first place. There's a trip to Fashion Week in Paris, and this chapter is so poignant.
Oh, yeah, I love fashion. I've always loved fashion. It's just, it's play to me. It's art. I mean, the older I got, the more I started looking at the way that our culture looks at fashion a bit more critically. And I went through different phases with that. You know, when I first sort of had a really radical feminist awakening, I was very critical of fashion. I got rid of all my clothes that I thought had been created by a man to objectify my body, which frankly left me with very little to wear.
I was going to say.
It wasn't very attractive either, but it was its own look for a moment. And prior to that, that was in my very early 20s. Prior to that, in my teens, I was goth. And I mean, the goth subculture is like very fashion focused. It's very high Victorian, you know, black ruffles and, you know, stuff like that. So it's always been a source of inspiration and play for me. And I, after kind of disavowing it through feminism, I found my way back around to it, partly because third wave feminism came back and kind of reclaimed all of the really, a lot of wonderful things that got sort of fearfully discarded by second wave feminism. And I started thinking how, you know, the way that our culture is so weird about women who care about fashion. It's like, on the one hand, we're pressured to look particular ways. We're pressured to look great all the time. But then if you care too much, then you're seen as sort of unintelligent. And it's just this terrible loop, misogynistic loop, you know? And if you think about it, fashion is the one art form that we all interface with daily. It's the one form of art we all buy. We put on clothes, and
at least once a day.
At least once a day. I know if you're lucky, you get some costume changes in there. But yeah, and you know, I've always been a really big thrifter. I dare I say it is genetic. I come from, you know, a long line of old women who were really great at the Salvation Army, who in my town, the Salvation Army would actually call my Auntie Ella when a new load of clothes came from Boston, and she'd be the first one down there sifting through it. So yeah, I love fashion, and I got the chance to have a dream come true that I never thought would happen for me. And I got to go to Paris Fashion Week and actually go to some shows. And I did that because I'm friends with Beth Ditto. And at the time I was helping her write her memoir, Cold to Diamonds. And it just sort of, I just got invited. And it's the kind of thing, if you can afford to do it, which I could miraculously, how can you say no? I mean, I don't know if I'll ever have that opportunity again. And it was breathtaking. It was basically one of the best things that ever happened to me, was getting to, you know, sit at a Vivienne Westwood show, sit at a Karl Lagerfeld show. I got to go to Chanel. I got to go to, where else did I go? Love, like just tons of fashion lines.
And so I want to talk to you about, this is kind of hitting on some of the other stuff we've talked about, but the way this chapter ends, I think that no matter what anyone has struggled with in their life, you can relate to this. Like, you just found yourself weeping in the aftermath of this experience and had an interaction with your sister that I wonder if you can share.
Sure. I mean, between jet lag and the crazy schedule of sleep deprivation I was on, like staying up really late and then getting up very early to go to these some of these fashion shows, I was, and not eating enough because you're just running from show to show, I was in this pretty fragile state. And I actually got, Beth gave me a purse that, you know, she was there as a guest of Fendi. And, so she was given lots of beautiful, you know, items from Fendi. And she gave me a purse that blew my mind. I mean, it's just so incredible. And I went back to my hotel room, and just the scope of where I was, you know, I was sitting in this gorgeous hotel room, which was, again, you know, it was a hotel room that Beth wasn't using, so she offered it to me. And I'd just gone to the Fendi offices, and I was going to the Fendi party because the Gossip were playing at it. And I just thought about my life. You know, I grew up really broke, and the destiny that seemed to be set for me was basically like having a baby pretty early and getting some sort of like stable, boring job in a crappy town. I don't even know what that job would have been. And just to see where I'd come from, I just started crying and just wished that I could, I talked to my sister, and, you know, she too, coming up in the same place and economic structure that I came up in, she's seen her dreams come true also, you know. And when I told her what I was feeling, I felt sort of embarrassed. She was like, no, you know, you need to go in your mind and go back to the 13-year-old you who thought there was no escape and no way for you to have a life as large as the life you were longing for, and tell yourself, like, you did it, you know, don't worry, you know, it's somehow going to happen for you. And she told me that, you know, she did that for herself, you know, kind of went back in time in her mind and kind of reassured the little kid that was getting like bullied at school at this, like, we went to really tough schools, like Catholic schools with like tough Italian girls who would like beat you up. And just tell that kid, like, you know, it's going to be okay. You're going to have like a lovely husband and beautiful babies, and you're going to live in California, and you're going to get out of this place. So yeah, it was, you know, and I was jet lagged and sleep deprived. And I was like, oh my God, just like crying, you know, sitting, hugging my purse, emailing with my sister, who I love so much.
But now you are married, right? And a mom.
Yeah, this is true.
Talk to me about the role of those milestones in being a grown up.
Well, you know, I was always very, you know, for a long time, I didn't think anything about having a child. I was, you know, a mess. I was, you know, an active alcoholic, and I only wanted to party, and it just was the furthest thing from my mind. But as I got sober, you want different things. And I started to just think about, like, do I even want this? It had felt so off limits to me having a baby because of money, because I'm queer. Like, how am I even going to do it? I'd been partnered with people who, you know, were pretty unstable financially and or emotionally, or didn't want kids at all either. So it just seemed like a non-issue until it suddenly became more of an issue. And my sister started having children, and I liked being around them, and I was good with them. And it just seemed like this whole world that I hadn't thought was ever an option for me was beginning to open up, and I started seeing that maybe I wanted it. And you know, I'm just very into experiencing everything that a person can experience on Earth. And it became more of like, I want to know what this is like. I want this experience. I want to, you know, experience being pregnant. I want to experience this kind of love and bond that people have with their kids. And so I started realizing that, you know, if I had tons of money, it would be a no-brainer. I would definitely get pregnant. I was like, yeah, absolutely. So when I realized the only thing sort of holding me back was economics and the instability of an artist's income, then I started feeling a little aggravated, like, oh, so only, you know, rich people are allowed to have this, you know, beautiful kind of human experience. And I just decided to go for it and to see where it took me. I was single at the time. And I asked a friend of mine who is an amazing activist and drag queen and artist if he would donate his sperm, and he said yes. And he started coming over my house and, you know, doing his thing in the kitchen. And then my really good friend Tara Jepson, who's an author, also would bring me the bowl, the warm bowl, into the bedroom where I was waiting. And we were just doing this in this really DIY sort of weird queer community way of trying to get me pregnant. And we did it for a while, and it wasn't working. And I blogged about it throughout. I did a blog called Getting Pregnant with Michelle T that you can still find on exojane.com. I was really into the weird, suddenly I was part of this whole different world, you know, of women trying to get pregnant. And it was really strange and funny and poignant. And you might be able to hear now. And so
good timing on that,
right? Thank you. So after while I'm in the midst of this, I met the person who, you know, ultimately became my wife. And I was pretty jaded about dating at that point. And she was cute, and I went on a date with her, and I didn't think anything would happen about it. And then it turned out she's like a marvelous person. She's just really incredible. And the deeper I got in with her, I hadn't told her I was trying to get pregnant, because, like, why bother? It's none of her business. It's probably not going to go anywhere. And then all of a sudden it seemed like, oh, no, I've waited far too long to tell her that I'm trying to get pregnant. What am I doing?
You know, she's an awkward thing to bring up on an early date.
Yes, it is. And it was really funny. Like, all of my female friends were very, like, finger snappy, like, you don't know her anything, like, you don't know her, like, it's none of her business. And then all of my butch friends, you know, who are dating femmes, are like, oh my God, you didn't tell her? You gotta tell her right now, because they're imagining, what if this girl I'm dating is trying to get pregnant and nobody's telling me? So I told her, and it was really beautiful, because as it happened, you know, her main thing in the world, she's not an artist, and so she doesn't have that kind of split drive. She wants a family, like, that's her passion. And so, you know, she was very respectful of, like, this is early, this is your thing that you're doing, but just so you know, I support it. I'm like, so you still want to go on dates with me? And she said yes, and it was very sweet. And then, you know, as we got closer, it became our thing. And I realized that, well, she put me on her health insurance. You know, I was trying to get pregnant with no health insurance, which is a bummer, but I didn't have health insurance. So she had a great job. She put me on her health insurance, and we got my uterus checked out. And as it happened, my uterus was old, and my eggs were, I had less eggs than the average woman my age. And the average woman my age had, you know, not that many eggs. So we realized it really wasn't going to happen without medical intervention. And so we went that route, and we did three tries, and I got pregnant. The first time I didn't. The second time I had a miscarriage. I wish they told you up front, you know, you're probably going to miscarry at some point. I mean, I think all women who are getting pregnant through any means should be told, frankly, the chances of you miscarrying at some point in this journey are high. It's so common, but nobody really talks about it, and people kind of keep it a secret. There's that whole sort of fearful tradition of not telling people you're pregnant until you're far enough along so that you can keep your possible miscarriage a secret, which I think does a really big disservice to women. So, you know, my second pregnancy, I did miscarry, and I miscarried the day before our wedding, which was really intense. I know.
It was intense.
It was intense, but it turned out that the wedding was such a beautiful, like, love fest that it was really perfect. It was what I needed, I guess. And then the third time we got pregnant, and now we have a 4-year-old. Almost 4-year-old.
I am curious, like, this whole journey you've had, What would you say to young feminists, young artists, young people on the margins of what you might call mainstream early adult life in America, for whatever particular reason they may happen to be there? Do you have words of wisdom for the young kind of Michelles out there?
I think that when you're in your, you know, your early 20s, like if you truly want to be an artist, I think you just need to put that first. You need to put it before relationships. You need to put it before paid work. You need to put it before, you know, family. I just think, I mean, this is what I did, you know, and I worked my butt off and I did a lot of stuff for free. I still work for free a lot because a lot of times the communities that, you know, need me don't have money. And you just hustle your butt off and you put that art first because you are the only person that will put your art first. There's always people who are trying to pull you away from your art and they don't mean to do it. They're not trying to sabotage you, but you know, your friends want to hang out with you. Your dates want to go on a date with you. Like people want to be around you, and art making can be so intimidating. It's easy to just say, okay, yeah, I'm just going to go and do this tonight instead of stay in and work on my book. Stay in and work on your book.
Michelle T., thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Michelle is the author of a gazillion memoirs, and she's going to be speaking at the Raven in Lawrence on September 20th. Up next, change is coming to the Folly, and so is Olita Adams. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And in just a minute, we'll be talking to Kansas City's own Olita Adams, if I may be so bold as to claim her as ours. She's a Grammy-nominated singer and pianist whose big debut album came out in 1990. That was when her career took off. She has an international following, but she got famous here, and she still lives here. She's got a show at the Folly later this season, and we're talking about it today because this weekend is when the public gets to see the newly renovated Folly for the first time. Olita's show is the highlight of a new era for the theater. James Maiden is here from the Folly to tell us a little bit about the updates. Hi, James.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
What has been going on?
Oh, my goodness. So we are in the process of wrapping up a $2.5 million renovation. This renovation was paid for mostly by, well, actually entirely out of local community donors and supporters. It is an entire renovation, redoing the lobbies. So obviously we would never touch the historic hall itself.
And so tell me, why, first of all, what it was that needed updating about the lobby and how that whole experience of entering this space is going to be different.
Yeah, so it actually all started, I want to say, about last year. Our team, our development, our board, they'd been working on this for almost 3 years now. It's part of this Folly 2020 campaign. And one big part that we don't talk about a whole lot is the HVAC system.
That is not usually one of the top things on a PR person's list.
No, it was not very sexy.
Here's how we heat and cool our space.
So the Folly itself was on this system that if we wanted to heat or cool one space, we had to do the entire theater. So the goal was, how can we become more economical? Because it was so expensive. So we worked with Train, and we are, that this one part is actually done. It was an $870,000 HVAC unit. That includes a humidity controlled room worked on, Kissick worked on that with us, for the pianos. We have two pianos that we house at the theater. But then this new
pianos and Forgive me. I mean, I think this is obvious to people who are musicians and who work with pianos all the time. When I learned this, it kind of blew my mind. I mean, they have pianos have specific environmental needs.
Yes. If there is a, you only have a little bit of a leeway with pianos. And if the humidity changes too much, which as our weather keeps becoming more weird, best way I can put it, it affects, especially in a theater that is 118 years old, it's easily affected by that. So we had to get this room updated so that we didn't warp these $100,000 pianos.
Yeah.
But so that part is actually all wrapped up. So that's awesome. This new HVAC unit allows us to control each room individually, which saves us a ton of money. So when we found out that we hit this level, we then went to donors and said, you know, we have enough to start this next campaign. We want your help. And the original main lobby that most people enter into, they see this. It had the marble floor, the big silver columns. Everyone was used to seeing it. But it was a very commercial-looking space. And we wanted to kind of harken back to the days when the Folly was. People would show up. They felt comfortable. It was an easy flow. We wanted to provide a better experience for all the people that came in.
Well, what is the significance of having Olita Adams included in this season, ushering in kind of a new era in some ways?
Yeah. So Olita, obviously, beyond just being a Kansas City local, she has a voice of change. And her concert kind of marks the next step for the Folly Theater. As her concert on November 17th, the theater will be completely redone. We'll have brand new tile, a brand new bar that curves beautifully. Helix worked on the design, which was amazing. And we'll have this gorgeous shareholders room that is now more of a lounge for our patrons. We want them to be able to go up there prior to a show and relax. And Olita's concert's kind of the kickoff. It'll be done before that, but the finishing touches will be all done before her concert. And we wanted to show that we're here after 118 years. We're here for another 120. And I think that this concert and the style that she brings is going to be, it's just going to sync up so well.
The voice of change is the big thing for you.
Exactly.
Well, James Maiden, thank you so much for updating us on what's going on at the Folly.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And now, Olita Adams, good morning.
Good morning.
I am sure a lot of our listeners know your story very well, but for those who don't, let's start with the year 1990 in your life. That's when your breakout album debuted.
Right. I think things really happened for me in Kansas City when I was performing in, I suppose around 85 at the Hyatt. And Tears for Fears heard me because they were staying there. They heard me performing. And 2 years later, around 87, they called me up. They hunted me down.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, they searched for you.
Yes.
It's sort of written in music legend.
Exactly.
Searched for this voice they heard in Kansas City.
Because they wanted me to sing on their CD, Woman in Chains, from their songs. I just went blank. So,
well,
songs
album, from. It was from Sowing the Seeds of
Sowing
Love.
Sowing the
right?
Seeds of Love.
And
yeah,
there were three
thank you.
Songs that you
it's
sang.
Early.
On.
There were three songs. And Sowing the Seeds of Love, and played as well, played piano on. And so I got a chance to record with them the next year in 88. And because of the work I did with them, I ended up getting my own contract with Polygram Fontana in England. And then I toured with them for half of a year, and then great things happened. My record was released, and I have to say Oprah was very instrumental in pushing things over into gold and platinum, and the rest is history.
Well, so what had you been up to before then? You were singing at the Hyatt, but tell me more about your career and life in Kansas City at this moment when Tears for Fears, I don't want to say discovered you, because there's something about that that's just like you already existed, but it, before Tears for Fears introduced you to the larger world.
You know, I had been performing around the States. I'm originally from the state of Washington. I was born in Seattle and raised in Yakima, Washington, a small town there in Washington State. And I traveled all over America. I settled here in Kansas City because it was great to me. They were very good to me. And
When you were a touring musician.
Oh, yeah, yeah. A touring, that means, you know, have car, we'll travel. Have piano, we'll play.
Right.
And I felt really good about having a job. You know, I got a steady job here in Kansas City so that I didn't have to travel around a whole lot anymore.
And the Hyatt was a real scene in the 80s.
Well, the Hyatt was. They actually asked me to perform there because of the problem that happened with the second story.
The Skywalk.
Building. Yes.
Yeah,
and
that
I think
collapsed.
That was probably 80 or so, something like that.
Early 80s, sometime, yeah.
And they asked me to come because people had stopped patronizing the place. And I had a following, and Crown Center hotel no longer wanted me there. So they called me up and said, we'll take her. And although I lost half of my following at that time because so many people had helped to rescue the bodies from the fallen building.
They just didn't want to go back.
So I did go there and, you know, who knew, you know, that things would turn out the way that they did, that Tears for Fears would be there that night. I did not meet them that night at all.
They just heard you.
They heard me. They sat there. They cried. They enjoyed the show. And then when they when Roland and Kurt had written this song called Woman in Chains, they felt like I could bring something special to that song.
Would you, I mean, when you were, when you found out, when they succeeded in tracking you down, and you find out later that, like, these famous kind of pop musicians had stayed in this hotel, had been weeping at the sound of your voice, was that surreal for you?
Yeah, actually, it was Roland who called me up. I remember it was a September morning, and I was in my house just enjoying life and in 87. And, you know, when you first hear the phone call, you're suspicious. It's like, is someone playing a joke on me? But the accent sounds authentic. But then the thing that got me was that he told me the songs that I sang. I was singing Everything Must Change, the songs that are going now. Everything Must Change, and I got to sing my song. And I realized how serious he was. And then they came and visited me here in Kansas City, and they stayed around for 3 days to just chat with me, and we could share music and talk. And they were very generous to me, and I'm very grateful to them for helping my career to get the boost that I got.
I want to talk more about your career shortly, but first, just, you aren't originally from here. The fact that you've stayed is kind of this amazing and in some ways pretty unusual thing, given the scope of your musical career, but especially considering that you had an upbringing elsewhere. Can you tell me a little bit about your childhood in Washington State?
I was raised by my great uncle, who was a Southern Baptist minister, and he had a church in Seattle, and he also had a church in Yakima, Washington, which was 253 miles away. So every other weekend, we would drive back and forth, you know, and through the pass, the mountain pass, which today I'm in awe of that pass. The mountains are gorgeous. When I was a kid, I saw it every weekend or so, and it didn't really matter that much. But it's beautiful in the state of Washington. And I was playing for the choirs. I had four choirs that I directed and accompanied at age 11. And I did that for about 8 years. So I learned an awful lot about music, about dealing with people, about being a leader, about singing from the bottom of my heart. It was a great place to begin.
This is a song about the people who raised you, right?
This is a song about the power of sacrifice.
Tell me, can you tell us a little bit about what inspired this, and then we'll listen for a moment?
My husband came home one day from shopping in the grocery store, and he said, I think you should write a song about the power of sacrifice. It's a word, the word sacrifice, that you don't hear very much with our entitled young people generation. And I think about what my folks went through to provide for me so that I could be able to take piano lessons for a couple of years, and so that we could somehow survive during difficult times.
Okay, let's listen to this a little bit. Can I make an observation about your voice? It is so powerful, but what actually amazes me is the restraint. I find it really unusual, honestly, like the level of control you seem to have over your voice.
I was trained classically by my mentor from high school, who was a Juilliard graduate. I wanted to go to Juilliard as well, but she said to me, it's going to be your chest voice that actually you'll find success in. And so she trained me to be able to sing with a full voice. I know that when I listen to my biological father talk and sing, that the voice was going to come down, because my sister has a low voice as well. My brother has a beautiful voice. My father has an incredible voice. My mother had a very high voice. And so I had a great range, but she taught me how to use it well. And I sometimes think that my voice is much bigger than I am.
There was, you know, I read a review of your album from the New York Times in 1990 when it came out. And the author of this article was talking about how there was this pressure on female pop vocalists to be sort of a cookie cutter mold, and that you and Mariah Carey actually were these two new artists who mm-hmm. were in very different ways diverging from that. There wasn't a lot of detail about what he thought was different, but as I read that, I really did think about this restraint. Is that part of it? Do you see that?
We are very, very different. In fact, we were up against each other at the Grammys, Mariah and I. The thing is the melismatic phrasing that a lot of pop artists and R&B artists, that was very popular with them at the time and still is today. I love letting the words really work for me, and I ration the amount of melismatic phrasing that I do.
Because can you explain what melismatic phrasing
is? It's when you take a syllable from a word or a word and you improvise with it to get to the next syllable. So, you know, there'll be a whole lot of notes in between, a lot of runs going up or down and in the phrasing. And although I knew how to do that, I didn't want to do that on every single note. I come from the school of Roberta Flack, you know, I mean, and Donny Hathaway. That's what I love. I love just, you know, holding a note out and enunciating and letting that note swell slightly, maybe, or expressing myself in a simpler form as instead of you know, it's like, okay, once to do that, fall off of the note at the end, maybe one time is good, but not every single time, because then that becomes like vocal gymnastics, and I didn't want to do that. That's the difference between us.
Well, Aleta Adams, we're going to get right back to this conversation, but hang on with me, okay?
All right.
We have just a few minutes left to talk with Kansas City's Aleta Adams on KCUR's Central Standard. She's got a show at the newly renovated Folly this season. It's not till November, but tickets go on sale today. So yeah, we'll be talking about Aleta's life in Kansas City in just a minute. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking with Aleta Adams, a big name in gospel and blues with 4 Grammy nominations under her belt. She lives in Kansas City and has a show here, which is kind of a rarity in November. And Aleta, you have just been performing with Philharmonics overseas, right?
Yes, with the Bremen Philharmonic. And it was, we played Bremen probably 4.5 years ago with my band. And the promoter thought it would be a great idea to bring me back in a different way. And I have to tell you that we spent 1/2 a year communicating by email with the conductor, Stefan Drabek, who is a very talented violist in the Bremen Orchestra. And he gets a chance to conduct the pop series, any of the... Sometimes they'll have rock bands or pop groups or whatever to guest star at the theater, at the Metropole Theater in Bremen. And so I was delighted. We sold out, and it was in the most incredible concert I've ever had. It was, I mean, I think they're still standing up right now. It was lovely. We had a very emotional night.
Talk to me about your decision to stay in Kansas City, because, you know, at a moment when you are doing, you know, you're like a working musician in Kansas City doing your regular weekly gigs, you know. It seems like having an album be so big that you were up for a Grammy, you know, like
how can an international artist stay in Kansas City? Why not? You know, the things that they do, many of them move to L.A. I tried that at one point before I moved to Kansas City or New York or someplace like that, Chicago. I'm very practical. My first deal was with a London company. And as far as I was concerned, if you're going to be in the air most of the time, why not stay in the middle of America? And I'm very practical, more bang for the buck here. And I love living the lifestyle of a small town that doesn't know it. The people are very, very friendly here. I love knowing that I can, you know, when I leave my home, my neighbors look after our home, and they've always been so accommodating and so friendly, and it's like a family. This is a great place to live, and if the whole world doesn't know it, that does not bother me.
Has Kansas City on some level meant an ability to keep being a regular person instead of a quote-unquote celebrity?
That's a very big part of it as well. You know, there are so many people who get lost in the stardom. The person who taught me how to live that out was actually Roland Orzabal of Tears for Fears. He says, you create your own hysteria. So wherever I went, you know, even when people will, you know, start getting hysterical, I go, oh my God, it's Olita. You know, I just simply look at them. I say, calm down. I'm a human being like you are. Let's just talk, you know. And I'm approachable. I don't like making a big deal out of it, you know. You know, I think that's very important. And then if I keep my feet on the ground and I have, I don't have far to fall.
When you think about your career, I mean, there are a lot of accolades you've gotten from audiences and critics and so forth. But what for you, just in your own heart, is the thing you're proudest of that feels like this is success to me?
I'm still working, for one thing. This is probably somewhere around the 48th year, I guess, of my professional career, and I'm still working, and I'm still true to myself. I think I should authentically be me. So the you that's in this studio talking to you face to face is the you that is the me that you get when you come to a concert. And it's really strange that people still talk about that today. When I appeared with the Kansas City Symphony a few years back, my orthodontist came, and he was so proud. He was so proud, and he said, wow, I couldn't believe it. You were talking to us just like we were in your living room. And I said, yeah, why not? We're people. I happen to sing, you know, and you do what you do. But other than that, you know, this isn't something where I consider myself put up on a pedestal. I don't live that life.
How have you resisted pressure to be something other than yourself? A pressure that I think a lot of people feel, and especially in the public eye.
Well, some people like that whole thing. They want to be lifted up, or they needed to be lifted up. I think I got enough of the accolades that I needed when I performed here in Kansas City in the bars. That was enough. Those people are the same people who are coming to see me. And I'm just grateful that people still support me. A lot of it also has to do with my faith. I know that you and I are connected as one, and I am not more important than you. I just feel so blessed.
Olita Adams, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gina.
We're going out on one of Olita Adams' songs, and her show at the Folly is November 17th. Tickets go on sale today. That's a wrap for Central Standard for today and for the week. You can listen back to anything you didn't catch the first time around at kcur.org. KCUR.org/Central Standard. And you can talk to us on Twitter if there's something you want us to discuss. We're at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Kathleen Pointer, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. Sophia Gillespie is our intern. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. And our theme music, which you are not hearing right now, is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. My heart won't lie. It's no